This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. Christopher John O'Shea.
Yes,
the
sir.
Irish contingent. 100% Irish contingent with us.
Well, I'm not... Almost.
Almost.
Close
enough.
It's close. But we have the contingency between the Irish and Italian just together.
Yeah, well, it's not like Bum DeSuto, half and half.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he's just a confused person. He has to be. He's split personality. Anyway, it's great to be here. We've ventured through the rain and the Beltway, and we're thankful for the safety, and we're here. We got an exciting show. We've got an author with us, and
now, why don't you tell everyone who we've got, and we'll just jump right into it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, that sounds great. Mr. Ronald Bailey, and the book we're going to be talking about tonight is The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. Certainly a timely topic. And just reading from the jacket here and a little more, he's the author of Echo Scam and an award-winning science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com. We also know he's got a degree in economics. He writes a weekly science and technology column, also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and has worked as a staff writer at Forbes. And he's appeared in, you know, all the big publications, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, and some others equally big Smithsonian. And the book, again, is The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. So,
yeah, that sounds good. When, you know, we like Doomed End, you know. Ron, we really appreciate having you on the show tonight, and thank you for your time. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about your last book, Echo Scam? What was the gist of that book? Because it kind of leads us into this one.
Yeah, let me give you a little background on that. When I was back in college back in the 1970s, I was being taught by my professors that basically the end of the world was coming. They taught me books like The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, for example, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and The Limits to Growth, which came out in 1972. And essentially, my professors, all very smart fellows, were basically saying that everything's coming to an end and your life is likely to be short and miserable. So, in the fullness of time, I'm working 20 years later as a staff writer at Forbes magazine, and I noticed that we are all still here. And worse yet, we're doing better than we were doing in the 1970s.
Wow.
I went to my editor and said, what I'd like to do is go back and reread all of these books and then go to the authors, if they're still alive, and ask them, so what happened? And my notion was is that I would read them and that they would come to me and say, you know, it's a really good thing, Ron, that I was wrong. That's not what happened.
No, you're really kidding. You're kidding. That's not what happened.
Well, for example, Paul Ehrlich, the guy who wrote The Population Bomb, who said in 1968, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in the 1970s in spite of any crash programs that might be embarked upon now. I called him up. We had a long chat. We published it in Forbes, and I asked him, so, you know, what happened? And he goes, well, I got my timing wrong.
Okay.
And then I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I was wrong on the timing. The famines are going to occur between 2000 and 2010.
All right. Was he right?
Well,
you didn't call him back up again.
Now, right? No, actually, as of, I have a most recent quote from him in 2014 saying there's only a 10% chance that civilization will survive. He is still preaching the same old doom. And he's never been right about anything.
So sooner or later,
who was the economist, MIT, in the late 70s? He said that the engines of growth are shutting down. They'll be shut down for like ever. I haven't thought about him in a long time. Same thing, a doom guy. And he was right at the beginning of the biggest bull market in the history of the country.
So, Ron, you know, these type of theories is big business in academia, isn't it?
Well, excuse me for a moment, yes.
You okay? Want some water? I can't give you any water.
Have,
We're on a virtual actually, call together.
I do have some water here. This always happens. I don't know.
You get too excited about this kind of stuff, you know?
Do you remember
all
the,
right. No, the
MIT guy?
No, I can't remember.
I'll get his name before the show's over.
In a certain way, it's not just academia, it's also activism. One of the things a story I tell about my first book, and my voice will come back eventually.
Well, we're going to take a break soon, so you're going to get a relief in a little.
But the a story I do tell in this book is my first book. The my editor said to me, "Ron, we're going to make some money with this book. It became EcoScam. You and I are both going to do that. But I want to tell you, if you had come to me with a book saying the world was coming to an end, I could have made you a rich man."
Mm.
The point is, doom sells.
It does.
In a certain way, what I would call environmental reality doesn't sell nearly as well.
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of these professors and a lot of researchers make a lot of money convincing people that there's a theory, and this theory has to be researched, and they're the one to do the research, and you should give us $50 million grant, or whatever the case may be. There's big business in this stuff, isn't there?
I believe that's true, but the point is that there's nothing wrong with doing the research. The question is, will you admit that you're wrong later?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing the research. But if you tell them you're wrong, then the grant money stops.
Then you should change research projects.
I guess that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is all the different theories that people have said, you know, we're coming to an end, we're coming to an end. And we're going to talk about the ones that are being promoted today. And how should we view them? You know, should we be concerned? So why don't you hold on, grab yourself a cup of water there, and we're going to come back. Right now, we got to go to a traffic break. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk about the end of doom, and I like that. We're going to end this doom. Tell us what's happening out on the Beltway there.
Do you have a financial planner? Have you ever thought of hiring one, or just need a second opinion? The satisfaction guaranteed service of the financial physical is designed with you in mind. Many listeners, just like you, come to me, Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, looking for a firm that is fee-only and can offer comprehensive financial planning. The Financial Consulate has not grown by selling insurance, annuities, and bank products. Instead, we pride ourselves on the wealth of knowledge we can provide to you and your family. Learn more about the Financial Consulate and the services that we can provide at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com. Or call to schedule a no-obligation introductory meeting at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
Anita says, I don't know what to play with that kind of with this kind of theme, you know? You know, I'll just play something neutral.
She does a great job. If you're just tuning in, we're with Ronald Bailey. He's the author of The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. And so we just talked a little bit about his previous book.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, ours is a financial show, Ron, and the reason I wanted to talk to you about this book is because, you know, as an investor, you got to be careful getting carried away with these, you know, doomsday scenario type things. You got to understand what government is taking seriously, because when government starts putting their power and their money towards something, whether they're right or wrong, you could make a lot of money as an investor, you know, so but you also have to be careful, because when they prove it's wrong, like, you know, the one you were talking about, you know, if you're on the wrong side of that trade, you're going to be in trouble. So, you know, that's one of the reasons we want to talk about it. So one of the other big theories was, and, you know, Bill Gates was into this one always, we're going to have such a big population, we are never going to have enough room on the planet or food on the planet or air on the planet for everybody to breathe,
right,
eat, and sleep.
That, right. A slight exaggeration, but yes, population doom was a doom that people were preaching for a long time, this notion of overpopulation. And what I do show in the book is that essentially that the current trends on current trends, what's going to happen is the world population will probably peak in about 20, 30 years at around 9 billion people and start declining. It may even fall back to below what it is today by the end of the century. And this is good news in the sense that this means that what is happening is that people are getting to choose the number of children that they want to have, and it shouldn't surprise anybody. But the richer people are, the fewer children they have, and the more they invest in the ones that they have. And that's a good trend for everybody.
So, you know, even if the population went to 15 billion, is there any reason to believe that we couldn't handle that?
Again, imagine if back in 1970, people said that essentially we couldn't handle the population we have, which is about 7.5 billion. So I don't like those kind of predictions. The truth is that people don't just stand there and do nothing. They innovate their way out of the problems that they create.
Which is really the gist of what your book is all about, isn't it? It's the fact that it's all about growth and free markets and ingenuity, dealing with these problems and saying, hey, we've got an idea here.
Right. I think that that's a good way to summarize it. I mean, another one of the scares, of course, that comes around all the time, and we just went through one recently, of course, is we're running out of stuff. The world is going to run out of stuff, and of course my favorite is peak oil. And we think of the TV programs and the inches of newsprint and the pixels that were wasted on peak oil over the last 10 years or so. And one of my favorite predictions was a guy by the name Ken Defies, who's a geologist at Princeton, who predicted, quote-unquote, world oil production will peak on Thanksgiving Day 2005. So I happened to look it up. On Thanksgiving Day 2005, the world was producing 85 million barrels of oil. Mm. You know what's producing today?
92 million.
About 93 million.
That was a good guess.
Peak. It didn't happen.
Right. And not only, not to mention, it's accelerating.
Right, and the price has, well, let's see, what do we call it? Oh, yes, collapsed.
Yeah, it's collapsed, and they're saying that they even believe there's even more oil than they ever anticipated. You talk about that in your book here. You talk about Saudi Arabia and Iran and countries like this who have the largest oil reserves in the world probably have 80% or whatever, fivefold more oil than they even think they have.
Well, that's true, but the fact of the matter is that the great thing is that technology solved the problem. The United States is now at the verge of being the world's greatest oil producer, and it wasn't because we got, quote-unquote, more reserves. It's because we got better technology, hydraulic fracturing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so, you know, so the concept is, and what you're saying is, it's not that we have to use government. We certainly don't need government saying, oh, we've got a problem here, we've got to do this and that. Really, what you got to do is let the free market figure it out. It's just like, you know, well, we're going to talk about this in a much more detail in the future of the show, climate change. That's going to be the big one we're going to say for the second half of the show. But, you know, technology's doing a great job with the climate change, with or without government.
I quite agree with that, and I have, as you say, a whole chapter devoted to first of all, I want to say I think that climate change is a problem, but I also think we're already well on the way to solving it.
But so let's get stick with that concept of government. This is a great story you tell in the book about the brilliance of government. So tell us about coal to gas. The whole concept. I mean, this is beautiful. This is government at its finest. So tell us the story.
It is. Listeners of a certain age will recall that we had an energy crisis in the 1970s. We're going to run out of...
We were in lines trying to buy it for 25 cents a gallon, thinking we were getting ripped off for a buck a gallon.
It was terrible, terrible. And so at the time, President Jimmy Carter decided that we had to... go on a crash program where we're going to turn our copious quantities of coal into natural gas because we had run out of natural gas, or we were about to run out of natural gas. And I don't know if people remember this, but we were closing down schools and factories and so forth because there was not enough natural gas to go around and we wanted it to go to homes. So his brilliant idea was that we were going to create something called the Senn Fuels Corporation that was going to spend what would now be somewhere on the order of $40 billion to build 20 gigantic coal plants that would turn coal into natural gas. And I happened to be a federal energy regulator at the time. I admit it. I got out of it.
Okay. You're a recovering government person.
I only spent 3 years at it, and my disdain turned into white-hot hatred during that period. But in any case, I managed to be at the front row seat of building the first and only one of these plants. So they spent something between $2 and $3 billion to build it. It turned out that we were not running out of natural gas. We were running out of government-regulated natural gas. And when we lifted the price controls, all of a sudden we had as much natural gas as we wanted. Who knew? And so this plant
See, now that's a part of the story I didn't know. We had price controls when he was on natural gas.
We did.
So he thought, due to the fact that he had price controls, that by just not lifting the price controls, that he wouldn't, you know, that... That's hard for me to even fathom.
No, I want to give him credit. He was actually the guy who decided to lift the price controls eventually. But he was still thinking that wasn't enough because he didn't really understand the economics. So they built this plant for $2, $3 billion. It was sold for 2 cents on the dollar to a local utility later because it couldn't make any profits.
And it's never ever really produced anything. Nothing's ever come out of that plant.
Well, no, they actually still make natural gas, but the way that the owners of the plant make it, and remember, they bought it for 2 cents on the dollar, is that the byproducts that they come out of the plant make it slightly more profitable.
That is amazing. Government, you know, comes to our rescue with all these wonderful ideas. We're going to get to that later when we get to climate change and so forth. But that's coal to gas. Amazing stuff that the government comes up with. Well, let's talk about this. I think we only have about a minute, and we're going to get back to it in the second part. The FDA. The FDA tells us all the drugs and so forth that we can't have because they're going to kill us. They're going to save us. Are they doing a good job?
I do cite several studies, but my favorite one is basically looking at a before and after situation where they got some extra tax dollars where they could speed up their approvals. And what it turns out is a good estimate is that by delaying drugs, they're killing 10 times more people than they are. By delaying drugs, it turned out to let me slow down. What they do is that they approve drugs that kill a certain number of people. That's just inevitable. But it turns out by delaying what ultimately turn out to be good drugs, they kill 10 times more people than approving drugs that turn out to be bad later. I hope that makes somewhat sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. But we're going to talk about that again when we come back, because that's a very good point about the FDA. And we've had some interviews on the show about people trying to get through the FDA with good products and how difficult it is. And it's not necessarily because they're concerned about whether it's a good or bad drug, but it's a lot of times it has to do with just politics. Somebody just doesn't want it to come out for some reason, you know? It's amazing stuff. Anyway, we got to get back to that. We're going to talk about that more, Ron, when we come back. Money, Rich, and Wealth. Right now, we got to go to traffic, find out what's going on now.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is that? Cold as ice.
Foreigner.
What's the purpose? Cold as ice. Global warming?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. That's pretty impressive. Man, that's so sharp, I didn't even understand it. What? I know.
Yeah, well, that was a hit.
I know.
That was a hit for, say, back in the 80s, probably.
So we're here with Ron Bailey, and we're talking about the end of doom, and we were talking about the FDA. And you say this, Ron, you say, better safe than sorry toward all new advancements. Never do anything for the first time. Anything new is guilty. Is that the FDA's motto?
You summarized what is called the precautionary principle.
The what principle?
The precautionary principle.
Oh, the precautionary principle.
Never do anything for the first time. Just dwell on that for a moment. The FDA sort of implements and is way too cautious and is probably the agency that, maybe the EPA, which most implements the precautionary principle. It basically says anything new is dangerous until proven safe. And, of course, you can never prove anything safe, so you're always hyper-cautious. And the flip side of it, of course, is that the stuff we use now turns out to be a lot less safe than the new stuff we're going to get. So we are actually harming our safety by delaying invention.
So let's make this theoretical concept, Ron. Somebody comes out, Pfizer comes out, and they develop a drug that's proven to be relatively safe, proven to be relatively safe and literally eradicates cancer in a person's body. How long do you think it would be for the FDA to take that and say, okay, you can use it on the public?
That's an interesting question. You've hit upon a particularly interesting problem. One of the things is that because cancer can be a terminal condition, the FDA's turned around in the last few years and is being more speedy in approving those kinds of treatments. But still, it takes way too long, according to most cancer therapists.
So let's say it was a heart issue, you know, and it pretty much eliminates heart attacks in people carte blanche.
Well, the average time for getting a new therapy out is somewhere around 10 to 12 years. And, of course, every year you delay, somebody's dying of something that will ultimately be able to be treated by that drug.
When was the FDA first started?
It was started in the 1930s. And it was started as a result, actually, of a particular scandal in which a drug company ended up killing some people with one of its tonics. And originally, the FDA was supposed to rule only on safety. And then around 1960, our government decided not only safety, it was supposed to also rule on whether or not the drug functioned as promised, what they call efficacy. And that gets really hard to tell, and there are very subtle effects here, there, and the other thing. And slowly but surely what happens is that an agency that is supposed to look at safety gets burned a few times. The truth is that if they approve something and it ends up harming some people, and most drugs will have side effects, we know that. If it ends up harming some people, then Congress goes after them, the press goes after them, the victims go after them, the lawyers go after them, and so they have no percentage in approving something. And so what you do is you delay and delay and delay, and you make these studies, you demand more and more studies out of drug companies, and the price of getting a new drug to the bedside eventually costs more than $1 billion. And so the drug pipeline slowly but surely dries up, and you end up harming more people than you're probably helping.
So, you know, a family story in my own family is my grandfather on my mother's side died in the late 1930s, and penicillin had been invented or created or whatever. He died of pneumonia, but they weren't able to give it to him for a few years. You know, he died, and a few years later, they finally approved it and started using it. I don't know if that's a true story, but that's what I've heard, you know. But let's talk about this cancer thing. You know, you say, you know, one of these doom things, you know, years ago, they said all of us are going to die of cancer because of all this stuff that we're putting on food and so forth and so forth. It's going to absolutely everybody in this country is going to have cancer and die.
Right. This was promoted most famously by Rachel Carson in her book Silent Spring. And she was particularly hot to go after a pesticide called DDT, which she thought was going to be part of creating a major cancer epidemic in the United States. And she had little stories in the book where a guy sprayed his office for spiders using DDT, and the next day he came down with leukemia. We know that that's not how these things work. Well, the thing I try to point out to people is two things. One is, I think, and this mostly surprises people, but that the incidence of cancer in the United States, that is, your chances of getting cancer at any particular age, have been declining since the early 1990s. It's been going down at a relatively slow rate of 0.6% per year. But what that means is that 100,000 people than otherwise would have been getting it, 100,000 fewer people are getting cancer than otherwise would have been getting it, and that's very good news. But it's incidence that's been going down. Your chances are going down over time. On the other hand, we are using and exposed to more chemicals, synthetic chemicals all the time, and it isn't increasing the cancer rate. Even the American Cancer Society admits that less than 2% of cancers are related to exposures to chemicals, both natural and unnatural. If you want to avoid getting cancer, exercise more, don't eat so much, lose some weight, don't smoke, don't drink, you know, the stuff your doctor always tells you. It's not chemicals that's giving you cancer.
So, but, you know, people would say, okay, Ron, I find that hard to believe because it seems like every time I twist and turn, somebody's coming down with cancer. And yet you're saying that the chances are actually declining since 1990s.
Well, what I'm saying is that the chances at any particular age. But the truth of the matter is, and this is something that I say in the book, I've talked to a lot of cancer researchers, the truth of the matter is that as you get older, the chances of you getting cancer are going to go up. Every cell in your body wants to be a cancer cell, and as you get older, your immune system declines and is less able to protect you against it. And that is just a fact. Most people who have cancer, and people should think in their head, who do they know who got cancer? Most cancers occur after age 55. In fact, most occur after age 65. And again, it's related to age.
And we're living longer.
Exactly. The cancer is going up in older people because they live old. They're old enough to get it.
Right. Perfectly logical. Perfectly logical. So we're saving the best for last. We're at the last break of the hour. This show's moved very fast because it's a great topic. And we're going to talk about climate change when we come back. And are we going to all drown? And am I going to have oceanfront property soon? That's really what I want to know. We got to take a traffic break. We're going to be right back. Money, riches, and wealth.
Do you have a financial planner? Have you ever thought of hiring one? Or just need a second opinion? The satisfaction guaranteed service of the Financial Physical is designed with you in mind. Many listeners, just like you, come to me, Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, looking for a firm that is fee-only and can offer comprehensive financial planning. The Financial Consulate has not grown by selling insurance, annuities, and bank products. Instead, we pride ourselves on the wealth of knowledge we can provide to you and your family. Learn more about the Financial Consulate and the services that we can provide at DrewTigg.com. That's DrewTigg.com. Or call to schedule a no-obligation introductory meeting at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
That's the song Heat, right? I know. By the Cruise Control Group. All right. I got one right, finally. Anyway, we're here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And we're with Ron Bailey. We're talking about the end of doom, and we saved the best for last. So the newest doom, Ron, is we're going to either heat up into this cataclysmic event that everything's going to melt and we're going to flood and we're going to get our arcs out again, or tornadoes and hurricanes and so forth are going to rip through us and that's the end of us because we're putting too much CO2 in the air. You actually say you agree with that to some degree.
I agree with that to some degree. I think that man-made global warming is occurring and that it could become a significant problem over the course of the remainder of the century if it goes unabated. On the other hand, I do point out that at the moment, you cannot really find in any of the economic data or other data that global warming is really affecting humanity at this point. Hurricanes are not getting worse. Tornadoes are not getting worse. Droughts are not getting worse. But it could happen. Sea level is rising. Again, the question is how fast will that happen, and there's a large range of estimates with that. I do want to say I'm on the record. I'm totally against government-subsidized flood insurance for people living on the coast, but
I'm against that, too. I think it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Your house gets knocked down, and then the taxpayers build it back for you. If there was a private market for the insurance, then fine. But why should I be subsidized to have a beach home?
Yeah, I'm with you. Ron Bailey for president. We're running out of candidates, Ron, you know?
I think we got way too many candidates. But that's another discussion.
Yeah, it's another discussion. But anyway.
But in any case, what's going to solve the climate change problem is essentially moving away from fossil fuels to other kinds of fuels.
But, you know, one of the interesting concepts about the climate change is that They're not, the escalation in temperature is not rising with the academician studies as to the level of CO2. You even pointed out in the book that it's the temperature rise isn't nearly what they thought it should have been.
No, that's correct. In fact, today there's a new study that was just published in a very prominent journal called Nature Climate Change, which pointed that out once again. Basically, what has happened is we have all of these computer climate models that have been projecting the temperature should be rising fairly fast. And it turns out when you actually measure the temperature, it's rising about a third to as half as fast as projected, which is very good news in a lot of different ways, one of which would be is that it means we have more time to adjust our economy to a low-carbon economy. But it also means that perhaps the models are wrong and that catastrophe is not going to happen.
Right. So, you know, here I want to ask a stupid question because I've never really studied this, but I keep hearing all this about rising temperatures and it's because of the CO2. But this is just a curious question, and it's probably a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is it possible that the heat temperature rise of our country and our world is merely just because we produce a lot of heat? Like out of our HVAC systems, our refrigerators, our cars, et cetera, and it's causing, and it's not the CO2, it's just we produce a lot of heat on a daily basis.
It obviously adds to the heat in urban areas. It's called the urban heat island effect. And what everybody knows is if you're in downtown Baltimore, downtown D.C. in the summer, it's about 5 to 10 degrees warmer than if you happen to go, 100 miles out into the countryside. And it's because we've created an environment where, of stone and pavement and so forth that absorbs heat vastly more than an area that has trees and grass and water around it. But overall on the planet now, that probably doesn't contribute enough to actually add a huge amount to the overall trend of warming.
So you think it is the CO2?
I think it is the CO2. Even people who are highly skeptical of the trajectory of where they think that it probably won't be a catastrophe acknowledge the fact that adding CO2 to the atmosphere, the physics are fairly clear. It will increase warming because what happens is that as sunlight comes in, it gets re-radiated back out. But what happens is that CO2 molecules capture it and radiate it back toward the ground, which means that it gets warmer over time. I don't know how deeply y'all want to go into this.
No, I mean, we wish we had the time to go into it in great detail. But the point is that, we just happen to be at the perfect time in history that this would be happening because we've got solar technology and wind technology and all kinds of new technology that doesn't require fossil fuels. Whether you agree with climate change or not, If Elon Musk creates a car that has the ability to go fast, his ability to go 300 or 400 miles, and doesn't have any gasoline in it, and is the same price as a gasoline car, it would be stupid for me not to buy the battery car. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
And therefore, capitalism is going to solve this problem much faster than President Obama or anyone else on the planet.
Well, that we need to get the government out of the way, but yes, I agree with that. In one particular power source you didn't mention, but I do want to tag, I would also say that nuclear power will play a big role.
Do you think we'll ever see fusion?
That's a much harder question. I was just at a conference where I was talking to advanced nuclear designs. And if I were a betting person, I would be betting on what they call liquid salt reactors. Basically, you can use thorium, you can use nuclear waste even to produce nuclear energy, and they are, as they say, or they claim, walk away safe.
Wow. Fascinating. Now, the big question, Ron, is batteries. If we change, if we get a new technology in batteries, that is a game changer, isn't it?
It is.
And what's the problem? We had a whole show on this one time, but
sure.
What's the problem in about 30 seconds?
It's very hard to get the energy density that you need in a battery. For example, a gallon of gasoline, the amount of energy that a battery holds is only a tenth of what a gallon of gasoline would hold. That's the best battery.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing, is that there is a race for this new battery technology, especially between China and the United States.
There is, but the chemistry is hard to do. I have every hope that human ingenuity will solve it, but I don't know.
So, you know, again, you know, one of the theories I have about, like, just say solar energy, that if government would take away its subsidies and, you know, tax incentives of people to buy solar, I actually feel that solar would explode as opposed to implode. What do you think?
That, again, complicated, but I think that ultimately solar power is going to become cheaper than the conventional power, at least in some niches. And my best guess is that solar power would be supplying about 20% of America's energy in about 15 years.
Well, look, if I put $30,000 of solar panels on my roof, the government's going to give me somewhere in the neighborhood of $13,000 in
right.
tax credits between the state and the federal government. If I were a solar company, would I try to bring that price down to $15,000 if my competitors aren't necessarily rushing to bring it down to $15,000 when I know I can sell it for $30,000 still and the government will give me, you know, make it cheaper for my clients?
I understand, and I think that we are already on that trajectory. The price of solar panels has been falling extremely steeply. I think it's somewhere about 20%. About 80% cheaper than they were only 5 years ago.
Yeah, solar is is already competing with fossil fuels even at these cheap prices, and it's going to overtake it in not too long into the future. Anyway, Ron, we're almost out of time. We got about 15-20 seconds. Last words.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I think I hope your listeners will learn that their future is probably quite bright.
The end of doom, environmental renewal in the 21st century, Ronald Bailey. Ron, we really appreciate your time, and you do a newsletter, don't you?
No, I don't, but you can find me at Reason.com. I'm there all the time.
Reason.com. All right, Ron, we appreciate your time. We're out of time now, Christopher.
We are, sir.
I got to go. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.